Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. I'm in the studio. I was just trying to take off my mask so I can speak. So on today's program, we'll be speaking about the Secretary of State, Pompeo, issuing a statement yesterday saying that they were going to use the State Department and U.S. government resources to combat the BDS movement, also known as the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. It's a nonviolent, peaceful movement to be able to put pressure on the Israeli government to give equal rights to Palestinians. And Pompeo is saying that this is a form of anti-Semitism, and they're going to declare it as such, and there'll be penalties for organizations that participate in that, and they'll treat it as anti-Semitism. So we'll be speaking to Amr Zahar from Michigan, an activist and a law professor, about that. He's a Palestinian-American from Dearborn, Michigan. He's also a comedian, so that should be interesting. All that and more when we come back. This is True Talk on WMNF.
رقد متحير في نومي يا الرومي يا بلاد الرومي حقروني ما لقيتش سومي والرجل سوق دلالة مكتوب مسطر من ربي حب نعبي نحب نخبي واللي قالت لي يا حبي طلعت شهالة بدالة في بلادي عايش براني شوف الحومة واش دعاني ونجيب فريخ ألماني حب نبدل السلالة قالوا باريس وميلانو فراري والفراغامو وتسمع كلمة تيامو وتشاو بيلو وتشاو بيلا خمم بالحرقة في بالي زعما نحرق ولا ليلا عايش في الدنيا زوالي نبكي والدمعة سيالة زعما نحرق ولا ليلا وي ولا ليلا زعما نحرق ولا ليلا وي ولا ليلا العمر يجري وانا نجري سوق ومرش نبيع ونشري ملقيتش حبي في فرشي ضايع وقتي في المونجيلا في الحومة عايش سومالي وحد مسئل على حالي لبس اللمي مالغالي يسي مرضينا بزبالة قالوا علينا حومة عربي كبرنا في بتاحي وفي قربي وحربي في بلاد الغربي وقالوا علينا همالة في البحر شديت ذنية بنشق الموج لداير بيا خايف نغرق يا الغالية يضيع اللي مضحي على جيلة خمم بالحرقة في بالي زعما نحرق ولا ليلة عايش في الدنيا زوالي نبكي والدمعة سيالة زعما نحرق ولا ليلة وي ولا ليلة زعما نحرق ولا ليلة وي ولا ليلة
Welcome back to True Talk on WMNF 88.5. And now we're going to bringing on or discussing the topic of that we have today, which is Secretary of State Pompeo saying that in the final days of, well, First of all, let's just go back that Pompeo is not recognizing the results of the election so far. In a recent press conference last week, where he basically said there, when asked about, you know, sharing information with the Biden administration or the incoming transition for a smooth transition, he said, we're going to have a smooth transition to the Trump administration or a second term of Trump. So he's living in a kind of a parallel world where he thinks that President Trump is has been reelected. And now the Secretary of State has visited the occupied West Bank in a settlement there, a wine company, which is actually a wine company that is on Palestinian land in the occupied Palestinian territories in the settlement. And they're pushing to say that to label products that are built in settlements, meaning products that are made in Palestine, and that would be made in Israel. So they want to change the label to say that it's made in Israel. My guest is saying that the voice is kind of choppy. We're going to try bringing him on, and if there's a problem, we'll switch to regular phone lines. Of course, he's remote, and this is the technology that we have. So about our guest today, Amr Zahar is an Arab-American comedian, speaker, writer, academic, and adjunct professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. He draws on his experience growing up as a child of Palestinian refugees, performing and lecturing on topics like politics, society, growing up Arab, Islam, and more. Note here, in 2016, Amr, and 2020, Amr served as a surrogate for presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. So we know where he stands on his politics. Okay, that was the music. So let's bring Amr on. Amr, welcome to True Talk.
Hey, good morning. How are you, Ahmed?
Good morning. Glad to have you on our program. So you are a lawyer and a comedian. How is that? I mean, by nature, are lawyers funny?
No, but but you know, both of them are can be used if used correctly as forms of, you know, storytelling and advocacy. So there are some crossover. You know, my comedy is activism and advocacy. And I imagine if I was a full-time practicing lawyer, hopefully it would be the same way.
So you're from, where are your roots from? You're American, but where are you originally from?
Sure. So, you know, this is like what I always say on stage. You know, people ask you, in America, people ask you where you're from, and then they ask you where you're from.
Where are you from?
Yeah, I am from Palestine. Originally, my parents are from Nazareth, Palestine, and also from Acre, Palestine, which is a city on the Mediterranean. And so that's where my roots go back. But of course, both of my parents were, you know, usurped from their homeland, kicked out. My dad when he was just a month old, my mother when she was 12 years old. And so my dad grew up in Jordan, my mother in California. And then, you know, they met in college in the 70s, in Berkeley, you know, a couple hippies. And they got married. And then I was born in Jordan because my dad was a professor there after college, after his PhD. And then he was kind of a political activist, so we got kicked out of there.
They met in Berkeley, but then you were born in Jordan?
Yeah, because my dad was got a job right after his PhD to teach at the University of Jordan. Chemistry, and he taught there, but he was a political activist there as a professor a little bit, and we got sort of kicked out of Jordan too, and then we ended up in America in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where I grew up until I went to college. Then I came out here to Michigan, where I now live in Dearborn, in the Arab Disneyland of America.
Why is it the Arab Disneyland of America?
Well, as some people might know, Dearborn has the largest Arab American concentration of any city in America. We have about 100,000 people in this city, and about 55,000 to 60,000 of them are Arab Americans. And Michigan as a whole, Southeast Michigan, the Detroit area, we think has about 500,000 Arabs. We don't know for sure, but a very, very large amount of Arabs. And so, you know, we have neighborhoods here that are just, you know, fully Arab commercial districts where English is optional. You feel like you're totally, I always tell people, I go and visit America and then I come back to Dearborn. It is really, really cool. It's beautiful. I mean, it's a quintessential American story in that, you know, people can come here and do well economically, be part of the society, but still preserve their culture. You know, the largest mosque in North America is here. You know, we have commercial districts, not just one, but many that are fully Arab, and it's really, really beautiful thing to see.
So is it a diverse Arab community? Because, of course, Arab, you know, there are, you know, dozens of Arab countries.
Yeah.
Is it a diverse community?
Yeah, so the community here in Dearborn is Dearborn itself is the biggest group is Lebanese. We also have a large group of Yemenis and Iraqis. And of course, we have Palestinians. There's a growing Sudani population. We have in the Detroit metro area a very large Chaldean, Iraqi Catholic population. We have lots of Syrian refugees that have come lately. We have a large Syrian population anyway. So yeah, it's pretty diverse. It's been growing, actually. Some of the smaller communities have been growing a lot. And so, we do have that level of diversity. But of course, while we have these like differences among the different sort of sub-Arab cultures, you know, the language, culture, food, all these things bring us together in many, many different ways.
So how long has the Arab community been in Dearborn?
Dearborn, the Arab community has been here. Some of them have been here for a very long time, you know, more than three or four generations. But mostly you had huge influxes in the 70s and 80s, especially due to the Lebanese Civil War. Yemenis have been coming pretty consistently and still till today since the 60s.
What's drawing the Yemenis there?
Well, the Yemenis first came for a lot of work. Now, of course, there's been, you know, some of the reasons people are coming is politics and war. But actually, they came for the work, and then, you know, what did Trump call it? We call it family reunification.
Okay.
You know, a lot of that, they've taken advantage of a lot of that. So, I mean, there's just been lots and lots of, always been a consistent flow of Yemeni communities here. But originally they came for work. You know, Dearborn is the headquarters of Ford Motor Company. So, you know, you had lots of people coming for work with Ford Motor Company. And then you have all kinds of other, we're the big three, right? So Chrysler and GM are here too.
Are they also in Dearborn
they're not Dearborn. No, they're not. They don't have plants in Dearborn. Dearborn is definitely Ford country, but they have obviously just, you know, close locally. There's all kinds of stuff for the big three. That eventually is what brought people here. But eventually people got into other stuff too. So now, of course, we have a very diverse community where not that many people anymore work in the big three. You know, people have their own businesses or they've become professionals or whatever it might be. But that's initially what brought people here.
So this diverse Arab community, Muslim community, back home where, you know, their roots are from, you know, their countries in the Middle East, there's a lot of war that's happening. There's, I guess it's very volatile, but then they're coexisting in Dearborn. Yeah. So what do you make of that? I mean, are they?
Well,
they're peacefully coexisting there, right? I mean, I'm assuming hear problems happening or, you know, fighting happening in Dearborn.
Yeah, no, they're totally peacefully coexisting. And look, it's pretty simple. I mean, you know, this obviously there is diversity and differences within the Arab community, but again, food, culture, language. These things have connected these peoples for centuries, and let's not forget that the borders drawn in the Middle East are not imposed by us. You know, they're imposed by colonial powers 100 years ago. And so, you know, what difference is there culturally that much between a Lebanese and a Syrian and a Palestinian and a Jordanian? Even when it comes to Yemenis who might be geographically, Yemenis and Iraqis who might be geographically a little further, you know, it's still, you know, 1,400 years of sharing a language really, really brings people together. And so, you know, I'm not surprised that there's not conflict. You know, there definitely is some classism and all that kind of stuff that exists here, just like I think probably with any other sort of diverse cultures. But overall, I see lots of connection among among the different communities here.
So, okay, we want to switch your attention, of course. Well, you know, Michigan is in the news a lot because of the presidential election. Even today, there is talk that, and I've been talking about this on my radio show for a couple of weeks now, that Trump is trying to steal this election somehow, trying to get his legislatures in some of these different GOP states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, to somehow contest the election and throw it to the, you know, the U.S. House, who some people are calling, you know, some sort of Hail Mary effort to try to stay in the White House. He has yet to concede because, you know, our electoral college system is somehow contingent on the loser conceding. And if he doesn't concede, it triggers all types of other things. But right now, Michigan is in the news. How did the Arab community vote in this presidential election?
Well, in Michigan. We saw in Dearborn, at least, that people voted pretty overwhelmingly for Joe Biden. And I saw that as a vote against Donald Trump.
What do you mean?
Well, Biden was not energizing much of the community at all. I didn't hear much people, you know, unlike with Bernie, where people knew his policies. You know, Dearborn voted overwhelmingly for Bernie in the primary. And unlike with Bernie, where people, when you ask them who they're voting for, they would literally tell you for Bernie and maybe name a couple of reasons why. This time, people were telling you, you know, look, I'm voting against Trump, and this is why. And so, you know, there was energy and higher turnout in Dearborn, just like there was everywhere throughout the country. But it was really an anti-Trump energy. And Dearborn overall ended up voting about 70% for Biden and about 30% against 30% for Trump. And in the Arab neighborhoods, Arab precincts of Dearborn, that was even higher. So we did see that in Dearborn. Now, we also have communities in Dearborn that are even among Arabs and among, especially among Muslims in America, are much more likely to be the communities that vote against Trump. So the two biggest communities in Dearborn are Yemeni community. And of course, the Yemeni community was targeted heavily by Trump's travel ban. And lots of families were broken up. So you had very, very high numbers of them voting against Donald Trump. And then we have a very large Lebanese Shiite community, which many of them politically were voting against Donald Trump because of his actions towards Iran and especially the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. So you had people who wanted to vote against Trump in general, and then you had communities who had specific reasons to vote against Trump. And that's what happened here in Dearborn. So the turnout was a little higher and the anti-Trump vote was very strong. And Trump won Michigan. He won Dearborn in 2016, but he won Michigan in 2016 by 10,000 votes. And this time, you know, who knows what's going to happen eventually, but, you know, Biden is ahead here in winning Michigan by 150,000 votes. So a big, big difference.
So some people have actually said that the Arab and Muslim community in Michigan helped flip the state towards Biden or for Biden. Would you say that that's accurate?
I would say that's accurate. We had higher turnout. In a close election, anyone can sort of claim victory. We voted against Trump in Dearborn, maybe about the same that we voted against him in 2016, but there was more turnout. So
I mean
in a close election, you know, anyone can say. We have a large Chaldean Christian Iraqi community here, which voted for Trump you know, and I would have to look at their precincts. I'm not very familiar with their geography, but you know, a lot of them voted for Trump, so it's not monolithic, right?
Why would the Iraqi, I guess, Christian or Catholic community, which, you know, many of our listeners may not realize that, you know, there are Christian communities within Iraq, why would they choose Trump over Biden?
Well, a lot of them were saying social conservatism. There is also a very, you know, Chaldeans, they've been surveyed out here, and about two-thirds of them say that they are not Arab, and about one-third say that they are. And we have seen, unfortunately, in the last, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, some really ugly strands of Islamophobia coming out of that community as well. There was a demonstration, a protest in the Chaldean community about a few years ago against a mosque that was trying to be built in one of the cities where they have a large community out here in Michigan. And so there's a strand of that as well. It's really sort of unique in the Arab community. And again, whether or not you call them Arabs, some of them do and some of them don't. But it's a really unique thing within the Arab community in America. So for instance, Chaldean Christians voted, Iraqi Chaldean Christians have voted, you know, for Trump. We have Palestinian Orthodox Christians who voted against Trump. You know, so I mean, even within our sub communities, nothing is really monolithic. You know, we're a very, very diverse community. The way you have to look at Arabs, I kind of look at it the same way we look at Latinos. So you see down in Florida, the Latino vote might go for Trump because there's sub communities in the Latino community, like Cuban or Venezuelan or more conservative people that go towards Trump. But, you know, you go to California where the Latino community is heavily Mexican. Well, it goes overwhelmingly for Biden. So even with you know, you can't paint the Latino community with one brush and you can't paint the Arab community with one brush. There are trends and there are things that we agree on, but there's also lots of political nuances and differences as well.
Right. So, you know, it's not monolithic, even politically, but you could say, as you said, 70% or so of the Arab community in Michigan voted for Biden. Last question about that. Did the Biden campaign do a lot of outreach to Muslims and Arabs in Michigan? I know that Bernie Sanders did, and there was a big effort there in 2016 and even in 2020. But what about Biden?
Yeah, whereas Bernie came here and did a huge rally in Dearborn right before the primary, Biden himself did not come to our community at all. What we got was a one small event from Joe Biden and one sort of like sort of passerby event by Kamala Harris where she stopped somewhere and picked up some food and left for a photo op. So nothing really substantial, no real communication. I mean, look.
No round table like Bernie.
No, not even close. None of that. You know, there was one Zoom call with a surrogate from Biden's campaign with the Arab American community, and that was kind of it. Yeah, there was no real outreach. They took us for granted. But again, you know, I keep saying, you know, you saw that video maybe I made about a month before the election where I said, hey, you know, in Islam, if you are hungry in the middle of the desert and you don't have any other choices and you don't eat too much and you don't enjoy it, then you're allowed to have a ham sandwich in order to survive. And Biden was the ham sandwich that we all had to eat for a second on election day because Trump was that bad. You know, Biden is lucky that he's running against, you know, this Islamophobic, anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian guy who's been auditioning for CEO of the KKK for the last 4 years. You know, otherwise, there's no reason really Arabs or Muslims would vote for Biden. He's not that friendly to our community. He's not friendly at all on foreign policy and the Palestinian issue and on other issues. And so, but again, you know, Trump is that bad that people felt like they had to go out and vote. So you did not see a lot of Biden signs. You did not see a lot of Biden energy in our community, but people felt that they had to go and make a statement against Trump. And that's why we got the result that we did.
That was more of a referendum on Trump than a vote for Biden. It's Yeah. Well, I mean, but even despite all that, it's not a landslide victory. I mean, you would think. I mean,
no.
Are you surprised or are you disappointed despite how bad Trump is? And some people will even say that if it wasn't for the pandemic, do you think that Trump would have won?
Trump could have won. If it wasn't for the pandemic, he definitely would have won against Biden. Let me say that. If not for the pandemic, he would have won against Biden. And if not for his mishandling, even just rhetorically, of the pandemic, he probably would have won against Biden. I mean, if Trump would have come out in March and said, you know, hey, this China virus is not our fault and the Chinese are to blame for all of this. This is America. We're not going to shut down the country. We're going to fight back. But hey, this is serious. So I need you all to wear your mask when you go outside. If he would have done that, he would have won. I mean, he would have won. You know, I think a lot of the reason that he lost was just people feeling that he was irresponsible in the handling of the pandemic, and he didn't have to shut things down. But Trump is just like, you know, he's not inquisitive or intelligent or really looks for creative solutions. You know, he's just not that kind of guy. Neither is Biden, by the way. So, I mean, you know, I think people just felt uneasy in a time of tragedy, in time of crisis with Trump. And so, you know, that's why. But at the end of the day, everything that they were telling us, right? Biden up by 15 points nationally, Biden up by 10 or 11 points in Wisconsin, where he won by less than 1%, Biden up by 10 or 15 points in Michigan, where he won by 2 or 3%. You know, he's up by 10 or 11 or 12 points in Pennsylvania, which he barely won. You know, all the polls were extremely off, which makes you ask the question, what is it? Are they either not polling Trump voters, or are Trump voters not telling the truth to pollsters? In either scenario, we kind of have to throw all these polls out the window anymore. I mean, what do they mean at all, really, when you have the kind of result that we had? I'm not surprised it was that close. I still thought there was a good chance Biden was going to lose, because it's the same thing as 2016. When the best thing either candidate can say about themselves is that they are not the other candidate, then you don't really know what's going to happen. And that's what happened in 2016. Trump won narrowly. Both Trump and Hillary were saying, I'm not the other person. And you basically had that here. You know, Biden was not campaigning on any actual ideas. Instead, he was saying, I'm not Trump, take back the soul of the country, all these sort of like high level slogan type platitudinal things, which don't really mean anything. And you had Trump campaigning on his ideas, which that's what brings people to him. And so the election started being a lot closer than people thought. I mean, yes, the pandemic created higher turnout because they have found out a lot of easier avenues for people to vote, and mail-in voting was huge and all that kind of stuff. Biden set the record for the most votes ever in a presidential election. Well, now the number two spot belongs to Donald Trump 2020 by a long shot.
More than Obama.
So, way more. And so, you know, we are looking now at this phenomenon in the Republican Party. You know, you want to call it Trumpism, you want to call it, you know, right wing conservatism, whatever it is. But there was, you know, it looks like it's going to eventually be 74 million people who voted for Donald Trump, who wanted to keep things the way they were. That is very, very important. And by the way, it's a big blow, even though, and here's the irony of it as a progressive, I know that progressives were the reason that Joe Biden won this election, because progressives said, we can't live with Donald Trump anymore. We have to fight back and organize. And so, for instance, here in Michigan, you know, Rashida organized very heavily. A lot of progressive groups organized very heavily against Trump. And so the turnout among progressives and among people of color was way higher. But because the election was close overall, and that's because white people still voted for Trump, okay? Because the election was close overall, and because Democrats lost a few houses lost a few seats in the House in purple districts, not in progressive districts, because they lost a few. You know, they didn't win a lot of the Senate seats they thought they were going to win. The Republican Party is probably still going to hold the Senate. Because the whole thing was tight, progressives will be the ones that suffer, because that's going to make Biden govern more to the center, which he kind of wanted to do anyway. It's going to make Biden govern more to the center and more to appease Republicans than it is to appease progressives, who are actually the reason, because of their organizing and turnout, that he won. Okay. But he's going to govern more to the center. We've already seen rumors of him possibly appointing Mitt Romney to something. We hear rumors about him appointing Rahm Emanuel, who's a Democrat, but a very middle-of-the-road Democrat who volunteered for the Israeli military before. There's rumors of him appointing Rahm Emanuel to be transportation secretary. We know now that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are not going to get appointed to anything. You know, this is going to be a centrist government, which is going to make the work of those of us on the left and progressives who want real change much more difficult, because you can gain solidarity in the Democratic Party to do what you want to do when it's Trump in the White House. But when it's Biden in the White House and Democrats feel now like they have some stake in the White House, it's going to be more difficult to gain any sort of solidarity with other branches of the Democratic Party with a president who's actually not interested in listening to you. Okay, this is going to be not a good thing.
Hold that thought. If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF. I'm speaking to Amir Zahir. He is an Arab-American comedian, speaker, writer, academic, and adjunct professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. He's an attorney, but he's teaching. And we're speaking about, you know, he performs all over the place, including in 2015, he headlined at the world-famous John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. And he writes a lot, and he uses his comedy for activism. He's a Palestinian-American. I mean, that's the concern, that what will we end up with Biden? I mean, the argument and the reason many people voted for Biden, especially progressives, was not only against Trump but also that Biden would be someone you can pressure, someone you can apply pressure to. At least he would listen. Bernie Sanders said that, you know, we're going to go to work and start organizing. Things are not going to go back to the same as before. Get Biden in, and as soon as he's in, start applying that pressure to make sure that the issues that progressives care about are pushed forward. Do you think but so far in the transition, it doesn't seem that way. Do you think that was a better strategy? I mean, I guess when you compare, the alternative was just not an option at all with Trump. So, right. But are you concerned that Biden will not listen?
Yes, I don't think he will at all. You know, again, because the election was close, he's going to feel, well, first, the election was close, so he's going to feel like he's going to wants to govern more to the center. But also, let's be clear, Biden is not interested in progressive ideas. He's much more interested in centrist ideas that appeal to parts of the Republican Party than he is interested in progressive ideas that appeal to certain parts of the Democratic Party. And so he doesn't have to be pushed to do centrist things that appeal to Republicans, but he has to be pushed to do left things that appeal to progressives. And so with the close election, it's going to be very, very difficult to make that happen. And so that's why, right, we actually have a bigger fight. And I think a lot of us knew that, but we knew the sort of sacrifices we were making in the progressive movement and on some of the issues that our Arab and Muslim communities especially care about, like Palestine, for instance. We knew the sacrifices we were making because Trump is that bad, right? I mean, that's what this was all about at the end of the day. So I think, you know, there might be a big sort of reckoning with Bernie and other progressives to really see what you're going to do. How long are you going to sort of be part of this honeymoon? You know, the Sunrise Movement might have it right. The Sunrise Movement, which is the climate change movement, they're already having demonstrations in front of Biden's offices and headquarters to say, hey, okay, fine, we helped you win. Now we want what we want. And it's only been 2 weeks since the election. And I think all of us are going to have to start doing that, because the fight in front of us is a fight against a centrist president who won a close election because of progressives, but he doesn't want to admit it. And this is going to be a major, major problem, because again, while under Trump, you might be able to gain some momentum with some middle of the road Democrats to do what you want to do because they just want to be anti-Trump, well, they're not going to want to be anti-Biden. And so we might find ourselves much more alone. And we're going to have to just organize in a different way.
Speaking of problems, I want to turn our attention to Pompeo. And if, again, if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF, and I'm speaking to Amer Zaher, a Palestinian-American comedian and attorney and law professor. And he's speaking from live, speaking with us from Dearborn, Michigan. I want to turn our attention to Palestine. Pompeo, there's a headline yesterday that Pompeo is going to label, or labels, he labeled BDS movement as anti-Semitic, becomes the first top U.S. diplomat to visit an Israeli-occupied West Bank settlement. The article goes on to say, this article at CBS News says, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Thursday became the first top American diplomat to visit an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. His visit comes as the State Department, in a major policy shift, announced that products from settlements can be labeled made in Israel. Of course, that's not Israel. It's Palestine, but they want to label it made in Israel anyway. The two moves reflect the Trump administration's acceptance of Israeli settlements. And then it goes on to say that they're, you know, they're basically using the State Department resources to label the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement as anti-Semitic and somehow racist. Is that a surprise to you, or what do you think is happening here? Because there's not much time left in their administration, and they're trying to shove all these things down when it comes to Israel. Right.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things going on here. So one of them is setting things up for whatever Republicans might want to run for president in 2024. So Pompeo thinks he might want to run for president in 2024. Nikki Haley, a lot of these right-wing Republicans who are super, super Zionist and super, super pro-Israel that want to set things up and show that they have the pro-Israel chops when things come around in 2024. And so they're making all of these things. The other part is, you know, this is stuff, some of this stuff is stuff that Joe Biden actually, you know, believes in. I mean, Joe Biden has never spoken out against settlements. He's never spoken out, or he's spoken out condemning BDS, condemning, you know, not just saying I disagree with, condemning BDS. Of course, we remember those of us who are activists in the Democratic Party, and especially who are Arabs and Muslims, remember during the summer where the Joe Biden campaign during the convention attacked and condemned Linda Sarsour, who was actually a Democratic delegate and fighting to organize votes to get people to vote against Donald Trump. So because of her pro-BDS views. And so, you know, this is a lot of this is setting an interesting table for Biden. So I think they're doing it. The Republicans are doing it because, well, they believe it and they want to set up 2024. But a lot of it is they might want to corner Biden, because these are just, let's be clear, these are the president, let's do a little law school class for a second, Ahmed. The president has basically full control over foreign policy, okay? The president through the executive branch. The legislative branch has really no say over policy. They have say over funding, but no say over policy. So for instance, you know, the president can decide right away to move the embassy to Jerusalem or decide to move it out. Okay, he can decide right away to do the State Department memos labeling the BDS movement as anti-Semitic or recognizing settlements or whatever it is. By the way, Biden could very, very easily reverse these things on his first day in office. He could make a couple policy announcements, make a couple State Department memos through his Secretary of State, and that would be that. And everything that they are doing here when it comes to Palestine in the last months of this administration could be reversed. But I'm not very optimistic that Biden is going to do that. First of all, he is sort of hawkish and right wing on Palestine and support for Israel. And he has huge within the Democratic Party. There's this group called the Democratic Majority for Israel, which had a major influence over his foreign policy. And they're sort of like a right wing AIPAC linked group that exists within the Democratic Party.
It doesn't even seem like they don't even seem to be on the left. It's just like almost like a Republican outfit occupying space within the Democratic Party and somehow has a big influence. They have a huge influence over foreign policy when directed to the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, they're like pro-Israel version of the Lincoln Project. You know, they've infiltrated the Democratic Party, but they're actually right-wingers, and they're here to take advantage of the anti-Trump atmosphere. But they really have right-wing policies.
But I mean, so that's just to qualify that. It's they're right wing when it comes to foreign policy, but they may be left on other domestic issues.
Well, they don't. The Democratic majority for Israel doesn't even talk about domestic issues.
Okay.
I mean, they're only there to talk about Israel policy.
Okay.
And on Israel policy, they're very right wing. For instance, again, when the Joe Biden campaign condemned Linda Sarsour at the DNC, Democratic majority for Israel was the first people to come out and applaud that. You know, so I mean, that's who they are, and they have a large presence in the Biden foreign policy team and the Biden foreign policy decision makers. And so the question here that we have for us, because like you said, this is just the last couple months of an administration making some of these crazy policies. The Biden campaign can easily reverse them when it takes power on January 20th. Will it? And I don't think it will. And then we're going to have to get loud and start talking about this. And then there's going to be a fight within the Democratic Party. Republicans will have nothing to do with it. Already you see the fight within the Democratic Party where centrists are blaming progressives for the close win. Okay, instead of thanking them for the close win, they're blaming them for the close win. And so this is what we're going to find ourselves in, especially when it comes to Palestine. Yes, Pompeo is doing all these crazy things right now. But what is Biden going to do? He could easily tell his State Department, look, here's the deal. We're not going to be recognizing settlements anymore as a legitimate place to do anything. Let's make a statement about that. Here's the deal. Made in Israel is not going to apply to settlements anymore. Here's a memo about that. Here's the deal. We're going to move the embassy back to Tel Aviv from Jerusalem. We're going to do that next week. And we still have the building over there. So that's what we're going to do. But he's not going to do that. He's already said very clearly that he was... what he said about the embassy move, he said, I wouldn't have done that, Biden. He said, I wouldn't have done that, but it's there now, so it's going to stay there now.
So maybe they're just
totally
trying to...
pleases.
Yeah, if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5. I'm speaking to Amir Zahir. My name is Ahmed Badir, and we're speaking about Palestine and Pompeo's moves in the final... Secretary of State Pompeo and the Trump administration making moves in the final days of their administration that are changing the realities when it comes to U.S. policy towards Palestine and Israel. Do you feel like they're changing the realities on the ground so it just becomes that's the new standard and then Biden is too afraid to reverse it, worried about future elections, that people will not actually stand up to this? Whether he actually, and you're saying he doesn't even agree, he may agree with some of the stuff that Trump is doing when it comes to Israel, and maybe he's just happy that at least, you know, he can blame it on Trump. Oh, that's the Trump administration that did that. But as you said, he can choose to reverse it, but you have a feeling that he may not.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I were a conspiracy theorist, I would say that, you know, he's actually coordinating with them to do these things now, or that the Democratic majority for Israel might be coordinating with the Trump campaign or the Trump administration to do these things now so that they become sort of facts on the ground. But by the way, you know, a State Department memo that declares settlements as part of Israel and lets you start saying, you know, made in Israel for things made on settlements, that's not a fact on the ground. That's just a policy. And you could change that immediately. But he's not going to. He's not going to because he believes in these things, Joe Biden. And so we have, let's be clear, we have the sort of most right-wing Democratic president probably ever, especially in modern history, entering the White House. And that's particularly dangerous on foreign policy. Remember, Biden has been in favor of the Iraq War, not just in favor, actively cheerleaded the Iraq War twice, in 1991 and in 2003. He has been very right-wing and hawkish on Israel. He has been never questioned. He does now a little bit for lip service. Let's see. He's never questioned blind American support for Saudi Arabia. Let's not forget that the Saudi-led murderous war that's really been a genocide on Yemenis has started under the Obama-Biden administration with their support. He has been hawkish on Syria, where he wants to create regime change and war in Syria. This is who he is, right? This is exactly who he is. And again, sometimes I believe, as someone who studies this stuff, foreign policy, and we don't talk about it enough in American politics, and it wasn't talked about at all during this election, presidents have carte blanche, basically, on foreign policy. Whereas when it comes to domestic policy, they have to go through the Senate and the House. That's not true with foreign policy, and the Supreme Court has said as much many times. And so the foreign policy implications of a hawkish Democratic president who is going to quash a lot of, who is going to have a Republican Party who agrees with a lot of his foreign policy, and then because he's a Democrat, he's going to be able to quash a lot of criticism within the Democratic Party, could be very, very, very dangerous for vulnerable communities who are the victims of American military aggression. And who have those people been pretty consistently over the past 100 years? Arabs and Muslims who live in the Arab world in the Middle East. We once again are going to find ourselves at the crosshairs of American foreign policy, and you know, it affects us here as well because we still have all these connections to our homeland. Ahmed, am I putting off the impression that I'm not that optimistic? Because I'm really not that optimistic.
Yeah, that's the impression I'm getting. I'm getting the impression that you really don't like Biden at all.
I don't like his policies at all.
But you voted for him. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663. We have a few minutes and some people are calling in. If you don't mind, we'll you know, see what they have to say. We got an email from Tina who says that I am from Detroit and know the Arab community has been a huge asset to that city and the burbs for decades, the suburbs. Detroit Dearborn also is the home of the Concert of Colors, sponsored by the Arab American National Museum, now a Smithsonian facility, and the Detroit Institute of Arts, the Wright Museum, Public Radio WDET. And, you know, there are so many things. So thank you, Tina, for sending that message. Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Joshua from Bradenton.
Yes, hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on
thank
True Talk.
You know, the big problem with Democratic Party is people like your guest. Who all he's doing, even with an administration that hasn't started fully, all he's doing is trash it because he doesn't like few ideas. And he thinks, and by the way, let me also say this. It's not just the so-called liberals that you're mentioning that voted Biden in. There are other Democrats who have a different stand from what you think is the right thing that should do. And I think that if you understand how policy works, just from the way you're talking intelligently, you know that things doesn't happen overnight. It takes little time. You have to give a little and give a little. But you just don't come out from the onset and begin to trash, you know, an administration that has not even started, even though you're coloring it, making it look as if that it's only you guys that put him in, whether it's a close election or not.
Are you hopeful? Are you hopeful that Biden will do a good job on his own without any type of pressure?
He's going to do a good job because Biden didn't get in there just him alone. He had the help from Elizabeth Warren, from Bernie Sanders, and the support. So why would anybody just start from the beginning and say, "Well, we know he's not going to do this. He's not going to do that."
Now, are you concerned? Okay, just to ask one more question, and then we'll go to our guest. Are you concerned that despite Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders helping Biden win, that they're not going to have any role in his administration?
I strongly believe that they will have a role.
Okay.
That's my belief.
Okay. Thank you so much, Joshua. Let's hear what the guest has to say. Are you trashing the Democratic Party? And what about waiting and see, you know, like before you decide on Biden? He has been in government for a while, so you kind of have a history there. But what is your feedback or response to the caller?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's never a bad time to stand up and speak the truth. Look, Biden is not, if Biden were this sort of unknown quantity and we say, okay, like we did with Obama in 2008, and there's some sort of optimism around him, that, okay, fine. But Biden is not. Biden has had 47 years of a resume, and especially when it comes to foreign policy, has been very hawkish. I mean, you know, maybe Joshua is not fully aware of the foreign policy implications of a Biden administration. I'm very, very scared of it because I've seen what he's done before. And he's not someone who thinks about the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And we've already seen, again, that his major boosters, the centrists and moderates of the Democratic Party, are already publicly and privately blaming, imagine this, they are blaming progressives for the Democratic victory. Isn't that weird? They're blaming progressives for the Democratic victory because it was close.
No, but
they're trying to say the things that they got branded with were things that were harmful.
They're also blaming them for losing seats in the House and some of these, and the blue wave that did not come.
Right.
But, I mean, in reality, the establishment, people like Nancy Pelosi and other centrists, I mean, maybe Nancy's a little bit more to the left than some of the other centrists, but it seems like establishment Democrats, again, push this issue of Biden and push the centrist type of policies. Right. And then when they didn't perform well, they're blaming it on AOC and other progressives saying, oh, it's because of you that we're branded as socialist and, you know, this whole issue of, you know, defunding the police. But I want to go to some other calls. CD in Lando Lakes. CD, you have a minute. Go ahead.
Greetings. Thanks for taking my call.
Good morning. Raise your voice a little bit because it's hard to hear you.
Oh, is that better?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, in the first place, he's absolutely right, your guest, that there are two different polls. One of them says 53%, the other one says 56% of Democrats didn't vote for Joe Biden. They voted against Donald Trump because we had to get rid of Trump. Trump was causing, irreparable things to this country. And he's absolutely right about who Joe Biden is. Joe Biden has 47 years?
Yes, 47.
He has a long history, 47 years of history, and you know, a leopard doesn't change his spots, and this leopard isn't about to do that. Whether or not we can hold him accountable and force him to do the things we need to do remains to be seen. I'd love to think that could happen, but I don't have a lot of faith in that. And his position with Israel is one that's very disturbing, especially that he won't undo some of the things the Trump administration has presently done and and has done in the past. And regarding Israel, because I'm all for Palestinian rights, I want to see the Palestinians treated properly. And unfortunately, that is not in their future. What's happened so far with the illegal settlements, with the restrictions. I mean, I think it was your show where your guest last week, Laura Friedman,
yes,
pointed out that a legal scholar in Israel, an Israeli, actually pointed out that Israel is an apartheid state.
Thank you so much. We're going to go to Karen in Dunedin. Karen, go ahead.
I agree with the guest as well, but I'm trying to be a little hopeful because of what the Sunshine Movement's doing and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and these other progressives that are out there motivating us to continue to push Biden. I mean, hopefully we can get something done. Bernie, I get texts from Bernie almost every day that we have to stay vigilant on holding Biden's feet to the fire.
So you're going to continue to be active and pressure during the Biden administration?
I think we should be, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. Well, some people are agreeing with you, Amr.
Yeah, maybe I'm not that wrong. But hey, so, but I mean, look, there is a lot of reason for skepticism with this new Biden administration. And look, if you are interested in progressive ideas, there's going to be a real test for certain parts of the Democratic Party and especially progressives. Are you willing? It's easy to be an oppositional force against Donald Trump. Are you willing to be an oppositional force against a president from your own party in order to push and get these things, which we know, by the way, are popular in the American society? You know, Medicare for all has become a popular mainstream idea. Having free four-year college, a public college, has become a popular mainstream idea. Having forgiving college debt, forgiving medical debt, making sure that we are a little bit less hawkish on foreign policy, even support for Palestinian rights and the Palestinian people has seen a consistent uptick in the American public. So are progressives and parts of the Democratic Party willing now to be advocates for those ideas, or are they going to decide to be part of this, Biden honeymoon that goes on? Because I know what's going to happen. I know that in the first 2 years, people are going to say, moderates are going to say to progressives, well, Trump did so many bad things, we just have to reverse those things. That's going to be the first year. And the second year, they're going to say to the progressives, well, we need you to shut up because the midterms are coming up and we need to make sure we keep the midterms so we can't sound too radical. And then the midterms are going to be over. And then the whole last two years are going to be, well, the Republicans are working against us. Oh, and we have a presidential campaign coming up, so we have to make sure that we don't sound too radical for that. And progressives are going to continue to get shut out of every meeting. That's what's going to happen. Are they willing to say, okay, we can't do this. We voted for Biden to get him out because Trump's that bad, but we can't do this whole celebration with Biden and play the game too much. We have to keep advocating for our ideas. That's going to be the real question that we see play out as the Biden administration comes along.
Okay, thank you. We're going to have to leave it at there. That wraps up our show. Thank you so much, Chimer. NPR News is next. After that, it's Radioactivity with Rob Lori. Have a great weekend, and see you here. See